brushing away Boindel with ease, which enraged the zealous warrior. His eyes glazed over as his fiery spirit took hold of his mind and spurred him on.
"I swore to protect Mir," he growled,
slashing at her furiously.
"No one lays their murderous hands on my brother's healer and gets away with it."
"I wasn't trying to kill her," she told him, forced by his whirring axes to focus harder on her defense.
"Traitor!"
He raised his right arm and feigned a blow.
"I'm not the traitor! She was the one who opened!"
The axe veered sharply and struck her armpit. There was a sound of metal on metal, then the crunching of bone as the blade passed through her chainmail and into her arm. The stunned Sander was still gasping with pain when Ironheart's boot connected with her kneecap, smashing the joint and sending her crashing to the ground.
"Liar!"
screeched Mir, whipping out her dagger. Tungdil held her back.
"Look at her, Mir. She can't hurt you now." "It was Mir!"
gasped Sander, trying to stem the blood with her other hand.
"I tried to stop her, but I came too late."
She swallowed.
"Lorimbas is her father."
"And I'm the mighty Vrakus," sneered Boindel. "We're not stupid, you know."
"It's the truth,"
murmured Sander, propping herself against the wall. Boindel's blow had severed the vessels in her armpit, and her tunic was drenched in blood.
"I'll never forget when she first arrived in Trovgold. I knew at once who she was, but she swore me to secrecy. She said her father would kill my clansfolk if I breathed a word to Gemmel or anyone else."
"Enough of your lies!" Mir pointed at her accusingly with the dagger.
"Haven't you caused enough trouble? You're the Thirdling, not me. Remember what happened in Parista? She made it look like Romo and Salfalor abducted her because she needed to hand over the information about Trovgold without arousing suspicion. Why else would they have spared her life?"
Sander closed her eyes and spoke in a whisper.
"I don't suppose... She mentioned that she'd been melded twice before. The first dwarf died of a fever. The second was on his sickbed when his chamber went up in flames."
She looked at Tungdil, who gazed into her eyes and saw nothing but honesty and concern.
"I realized she was after Gemmel, so I asked him to meld me instead."
Tungdil was busy reviewing what had happened in Parista, how he had fallen ill, and what Mir had said to him after the fire. "Mir, that time at the inn when I nearly died in the fire," he said slowly. "You didn't have anything to do with it, did you?" Her red eyes looked at him uncertainly. He grabbed her by the arm and pulled her aside as if she were a naughty child.
"Promise you had nothing to do with it."
Her eyes brimmed with tears.
"Tungdil, you can't take her word over mine,"
she protested half-heartedly.
"Promise you had nothing to do with it, and I'll never mention it again."
She looked at the ground. "You've got nothing to fear from me, Tungdil. After the fire, I realized that I couldn't. I didn't mean to fall in love with you, but..." She started to cry.
"Mir, tell me you're not Lorimbas's daughter,"
whispered Tungdil. He had never felt so betrayed. He forgot about the battle and the threat from the avatars. Nothing seemed to matter any more. She sniffed and dried her eyes on her sleeve, then looked him in the eye.
"Sander is right. I was sent by my father, Lorimbas Steelheart, to spy on the Freelings and prepare the way for a Thirdling invasion. I've always been pale-skinned. Nature gave me the perfect cover. I had only to change my eye color and invent a story about my provenance. No one thought to question my origins. Then you came along." She reached for his hand. "I was supposed to kill you, but my heart wouldn't."
Her gaze shifted, and her eyes filled with fear. Grabbing his shoulders, she spun him around and took his place just as something rammed into her from behind, throwing her forward. Tongdil reached out to catch her. Her mouth opened, lips moving silently, but she could barely breathe. Standing behind her was Salfalor. He was clutching his hammer, the haft of which was tipped with a metal spike as long as a human arm. The end was resting against Tungdil's chest, having passed through Mir.
"I would never have,"
she sighed, clutching at him.
"You mustn't think too badly of me."
Her dainty body went limp in his arms. In spite of the pain, she seemed to smile at Tungdil as she died. Salfalor drew the spike from her body. It made a soft popping noise as he pulled it clear. "Are you satisfied now?" Tungdil laid her down gently and drew his axe. "You killed my parents, and now you've killed my wife."
"Your wife?"
Salfalor was still clutching his hammer and staring at Mir.
"She was my wife, not yours."
With his free hand, he touched the blood dribbling down the haft, then rubbed it between his fingers.
"Mir was my wife, and she died because of you. I'll make you die a thousand deaths." "She was your..."
Aghast, Tungdil stepped back, then pulled himself together. "Let's settle this now," he said grimly, preparing to fight. They circled, waiting for the other to strike. Salfalor was the first to attack. In his arms, the mighty hammer looked no heavier than a broom. Tungdil braced himself, but the blow never came. In the background, Lorimbas was sounding the retreat. Looking up, Tungdil saw a battalion of firstling warriors on the parapets. Xamtiz had marched ahead with half of her army to save her kingdom from falling to their dwarven foes. Salfalor was torn between continuing the duel and doing his job as commander-in-chief. At last he lowered his hammer. His brown eyes contained a silent promise to resume the duel in another place, at another time. Tungdil nodded. Mir wasn't the last to die that orbit. Sander Flameheart was mortally wounded. Gemmel held her in his arms, while Boindil stood beside them, not knowing what to say.
"It's all right," she said,
her breath coming in little gasps.
"I know you didn't mean it, Boindil Doubleblade. I've heard about your curse."
He kneeled beside her, distraught.
"I'm..." "You don't have to explain. I forgive you."
She stretched her bloodied fingers toward him. Boindil took her hand and held it in silence until she passed away.
"Rakus must hate me," he muttered.
"Why can't he kill me and be done with it?"
His face was expressionless, but his eyes welled with tears.
"I should have settled for stunning her, but my fiery spirit made me cut her down. First Smeralda, now Sander."
Gemmel stood up and signalled to some dwarves, who hoisted the dead queen gently onto their shoulders and carried her into the stronghold.
"Sander was right. You mustn't blame yourself. You fell for Mir's lies, and Vrakas gave you a heart of fury. It's not your fault."
He rested a hand on the secondling's shoulder to show there was no animosity between them. Then he followed the others to the firstling halls.
"An ill-fated orbit," thought Tungdil,
gazing at Mir's lifeless body. Her leather jerkin was crimson with blood. He gathered her up and picked his way through the dead and wounded toward the retreating army.
"Lorimbas!"
he called loudly.
"Your daughter is dead, slain by Salfalor's hammer!"
He bent down and laid her gently on the ground.
"She's yours to take, if you want to bury her."
Lorimbas stepped forward, accompanied by a score of warriors. Salfalor wasn't among them.
"Curse you, Tungdil Goldhand," he said, kneeling beside his daughter and stroking her pure white hair. "You murdered my nephew, and now you've killed Mia. Everyone I've ever loved is dead because of you.
He lifted her up tenderly.
We'll never make peace. You're like your father. He started this misery, and it will end with your death.
Lorimbas Steelheart? Xamtes hurried toward them, followed by a cluster of dwarves. I'm afraid this is all that remains of the army that you sent against West Ironhald.
The firstlings are better warriors than I thought.
He shot a contemptuous look at the survivors, who were covered in gashes and burns.
The firstlings didn't do this, said one of them, wincing as he spoke. It was the Avatars, Your Majesty.
What?
Lorimbas frowned.
What do you mean, the Avatars? Is this the way the Dwarf Queen spared you? Because you promised to lie?
No, Your Majesty, I wouldn't deceive you.
The Avatars don't exist,
shouted Lorimbas.
They're a legend designed to frighten small children, stupid beasts, and foolish dwarves.
He hugged his daughter to his chest.
We were marching east, said another dwarf. The firstlings had turned round and were on their way home. We could see them in the range ahead of us. Then the cavalry attacked from behind. They were mounted on white horses and unicorns, and they rode straight into us as if we were unarmed. They were fearless.
He swayed, and one of his companions had to steady him.
Then the demigods attacked. They were as dazzling as sunlit snow, shinier than a polished diamond, and 5 times hotter than a dwarven forge. They were everywhere at once, attacking us with... He paused. I don't know what exactly.
He whispered wretchedly.
I was struck by a cloud of light. It knocked me over, but I got up before it could hit me again. Then I ran for it. After a while, me and the others caught up with the firstlings. They made us surrender our weapons.
At last, he had Lorimbas's full attention.
What happened to the rest of the army?
The warrior bowed his head, revealing charred skin and a few blackened strands of hair.
I don't know, Your Majesty. The wind was coming from behind. It was warm with glowing ash.
We sent a scout to the Outer Lands, chimed in Tongdil. He told us the same story. Queen Wei's soldiers were destroyed by the Avatars as well. It's not a legend, King Lorimbas. The Thirdling King hugged his daughter more tightly, smearing his armor with blood from her chest.
They can't be real, he whispered. We made them up. It's simply not possible.
What now, Lorimbas? Asked Xamtes bluntly. Do you want to fight me for my kingdom? Or will you join us at the western border to halt the Avatar's advance? He stroked the silvery down on his daughter's cheeks.
Everything I dreamed of has been destroyed. I don't want Gerdlegard to suffer as well.
He turned toward Tungdil, but something prevented him from looking him in the eye.
When this is over, we'll fight to the death. I should have wiped out your line when I had the chance.
He bowed his head towards Xamtes.
I hereby declare a truce between the children of Lorimbur and the dwarven folks. I swear on my daughter whose blood stains my hands that the Thirdlings will cease hostilities until the Avatars are defeated.
He turned to leave.
I'll summon the rest of my army to the Red Range, and we'll fight the Avatars together.
How many warriors can we count on? Asked Xamtes.
Enough to wipe out the threat, he growled scornfully.
Cradling Mir in his arms, he joined his guards, who escorted him back to his troops. As he passed, the Thirdlings lowered their weapons, bowed their heads, and lamented the death of the Thirdling Princess. Chapter 5. Borengar's Folk, Eastern Border of the Firstling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, Early Winter, 6,235th solar cycle.
Thousands and thousands of Thirdlings, and I'm letting them into my kingdom, murmured Belindis, still in shock. Do you think we'll ever get them out? We nearly lost the stronghold to them. They're invisible on the battlefield.
She and the others had gathered in the conference hall to devise a strategy for fighting the Avatars. It was clear that the demigods couldn't be defeated by axes alone, but no one had come up with a viable plan. They were hoping that a tankard of ale and some hot food might provide the necessary inspiration.
"Look on the bright side," said Boindil, forthrightly. "If the Thirdlings are burned to a cinder by the Avatars, we won't have to worry about booting them out."
He filled his tankard from the barrel, allowing a frothy head to settle on the dark brown beer.
"It might seem premature," said his brother, "but I think we need a plan for retaking the Black Saddle. Once we've defeated the Avatars, as we most certainly will, we should seize the Black Saddle before Lorimbas attacks us through his tunnels. His army will be weak, and we'll have the combined strength of all the dwarven folks to draw on. It's the perfect time to strike."
Tungdil nodded. "I've sent word to Gandogar, Glaimbar, and Balendalin. Their troops will take a while to get here, but when they do, Lorimbas will see what he's up against. We're bound to come to an arrangement." He bent over the table to examine the map. "We need to deal with the Avatars first."
"I've got 5,000 warriors," said Zamtis.
Tungdil looked at Fergus, Namora, and Rodario.
"How much time do you need?"
"I'm ready," said Namora. "There's nothing I can do until they get here. I've got enough magic energy to take them on."
She was lucky that the dwarves knew very little about the workings of magic. Otherwise they would have wondered how she could summon the strength to attack the Avatars without channeling fresh energy from the force fields. The Malachite was lending her formidable strength.
Fergus spread some sketches on the table.
"I dismantle the catapults here."
He pointed to the site of the battle with the Thirdlings.
"And move them to West Ironhald. I had enough helpers to get everything up and running. We can blot out the sun if we fire all at once."
"Excellent.
How about you, Rodario?"
asked Tundil. "Sorry," he corrected himself quickly before the impresario could protest.
"Rodario, the Fable Maker." "How kind of you to remember my title."
Rodario thanked him sourly. Rising to his feet, he assumed the air of a great orator.
"You see before you the greatest living Avatar trap. I have agreed to draw the demigods to me, to make myself the target of their wrath, to sacrifice myself so that my Mega, Namora the Unnerving, can use her powers to full advantage without fear of attack."
He cleared his throat.
"Naturally, I'm deeply honored to be an integral part of the heroics, but if anyone would like to share the glory..."
There was silence.
"Anyone at all?"
"I thought as much,"
he muttered grimly, sitting back down.
"The poor supporting actors always get killed off.
I hope Gerdlegard honors my memory."
"You're not going to die, Rodario," said Tungdil.
"I'm sure you'll be treading the boards of the Curiosum in no time at all." "I can see it already," said Boindil, swallowing the last of his beer. "The incredible story of how Rodario, the Fable Maker, saved Gerdlegard from the fiery Avatars. You'll need a few jokes to liven it up. Did you hear about the orc who asked a dwarf for directions?"
"Go on,"
said the impresario eagerly, reaching for his quill. The discussion was cut short by news that Lorimbas's warriors had arrived. Zamtis led the others to the entrance hall, where they watched from the gallery as the Thirdlings, bristling with weaponry and covered from head to toe in heavy armor, streamed through the doors below. Entire units were composed of grim-faced, tattooed warriors, the Thirdling elite. It was obvious from their expressions that they resented entering the kingdom as allies. For a moment, the stronghold was silent, except for jangling mail and the steady thump of booted feet.
"Are you sure they're not dangerous?"
ventured Rodario nervously. "If I were an avatar, I'd give myself up."
"If you were an avatar, Girdlygard would be safe," commented Boindil.
He sniffed loudly and snotted on the warriors below, missing a ferocious tattooed thirdling by a dwarven whisker.
"The famous dwarf killers. I know they're on our side, but I'm not inclined to trust them. I recommend you watch your backs."
Tungdil straightened up and clapped the twins on the shoulders. "We're needed in West Ironhald. It's time to save Girdlygard. This time, without Keenfire's help." They travelled through an underground tunnel beneath Samti's halls to reach the fortifications on the other side of the range. West Ironhald was a perfect copy of its counterpart on the eastern flanks of the range. Queen Zamtis had built the walls to match the improvements made to East Ironhald, ensuring that both strongholds were sturdy enough to withstand the winter snow. 6 fortified walls barred the steep-sided gully, leading from the Outer Lands to West Ironhald, protected by twin ramparts, 9 towers, and a bridge. Tungdil and the others were greeted by a remarkable sight. Lined up on the ramparts beside the firstlings were Gemmel's freelings and Lorambas's thirdlings. The 3 groups, divided by history, tradition, and outlook, had been brought together by a common goal: the protection of Girdlygard against invaders. Shoulder to shoulder, they waited for the avatars to arrive. Tungdil took up position in his favourite observation post and surveyed the thirdlings from the highest of West Ironhald's 9 towers. According to his estimates, Lorambas had summoned over 20,000 warriors. Zamtis was right. It would take more than the firstlings and freelings to defeat the thirdling army. He turned back to the gully and looked for signs of the enemy, although he didn't know what to expect. It was nearly dusk when he spotted a fierce white light at the end of the gully. Steadily, the light drew closer, like a pure white sun rolling toward the range, sending its scorching rays skyward and lighting up the clouds. Even from a distance, Tungdil could tell that it was dazzlingly bright. He could barely look at it without screwing up his eyes. "This is it," said Namora, joining him in the tower. She placed her hands on the parapet and stared at the glow. "Suppose we were to tell them that Nodon and the perished land have been defeated. They might call off the invasion."
"How would we get them to listen to us?"
"With the help of a maiden."
"Is Jerun hungry again?"
inquired Rodario, stationing himself beside the Maegar.
"Don't be foolish," she reprimanded him.
"The avatars respect purity, so they won't kill an innocent maiden."
"Well, I'd be surprised if they did."
She turned to Tungdil. "We need someone to walk out and tell them that Girdlygard is safe. I do it myself, but I'm not sure the avatars would listen to a follower of Samusin."
"Will they listen to anyone?"
"We won't know unless we try," she said. "Sometimes the simplest solution is the best." That night, a young dwarf wrapped in white furs left the stronghold. At only 24 cycles, Fiona Goodsoul, of the clan of the Orefinders, was a child by dwarven standards. Zamtis had chosen her from the group of volunteers, young dwarves who were yet to be melded. The wording of the message had been given to her by Namora. "Stick to the script," the Maegar reminded her. "If they want to negotiate, tell them you'll pass on their demands. Don't mention our army or our plans." The young dwarf listened attentively and set off briskly through the gully, heart quickening as she left the safety of the fortified walls. The dwarves watched as she hurried through the sweeping gully and disappeared from view. All they could do was wait and pray. The bright light moved closer and closer. Sometime around midnight, when the moon was high above the range, the light came to a halt, sparking in a flurry of excitement around the anxious dwarves. "They found Fiona," whispered Xamtes. "Fracas, protect the dear child." Namora rested her elbows on the parapet and leaned forward, focusing on the glow. "I hope it's enough to dissuade them from invading."
"Look," shouted Boindil, tugging at Tungdil's sleeve. "It's fading."
"Vracus be praised," cried Xamtes. "I'll melt down every ingot in my kingdom in honor of the smith." As they watched, the light faded to a faint glow on the mountain slopes. Then the gully was shrouded in darkness once more.
"It worked."
Tungdil smiled and turned to Namora. "You were right. The simplest solution turned out to be the best." Everyone in the stronghold and on the ramparts was watching as well. As soon as the light went out, they cheered and hugged each other. Firstlings, thirdlings, and freelings, together they rejoiced, their differences forgotten, temporarily at least.
"Let's see what Fiona has to say."
Tungdil shook the Maegar's hand and went to fetch a mug of hot spiced beer before hurrying back to the tower to wait for the plucky firstling to return. The night wore on. At dawn, the sun rose over the ridge, warming the shivering dwarfs with its soft yellow rays. Their confidence grew. But there was still no sign of Fiona Goodsoul. By noon, snow clouds were gathering over the gully, and Xamtes dispatched a band of warriors to hunt for the missing dwarf. It wouldn't be safe to leave the stronghold once the weather closed in. Several hours later, the warriors returned with Fiona, unconscious but alive. The Maegar examined her and diagnosed a mild case of frostbite from sleeping in the snow. "She'll be fine," said Namora, after reviving Fiona's fingers and toes. She patted the dwarf on the cheek to wake her, and handed her a beaker of hot lichen tea. Fiona gulped it down.
"I failed, Your Majesty,"
she said, shivering. She bowed her head wretchedly.
"I'm sorry, Queen Xamtes."
"Sorry? What's the matter with her?"
spluttered Boindil, peering over the parapet.
"The avatars have gone. There's no sign of them anywhere. Unless they're too darn pure for me to see."
"Shush!"
growled Boendal, giving him a warning prod.
"I got as close as I could, like you told me to, but the light was really bright. In the end, I called out and a creature of pure light flew toward me and asked me what I wanted."
The young firstling glanced at Namora.
"I repeated the words you taught me, estimable Maegar. But the creature just laughed. The noise went straight through me. It was high-pitched and cruel."
She took another sip of tea.
"The creature said not to worry. It would be over really soon. Then it touched me and I... The next thing I knew, I was here."
Tungdil looked at his friends' worried faces.
"If they're not here or in the gully, where are they?"
"In the tunnels,"
rasped a voice from behind them. King Lorimbas had joined them and heard the end of Fiona's story.
"One of my tunnels comes up in the gully."
Tungdil shuddered.
"They'll go straight to the Black Saddle. Your guards won't be expecting them, and the rest of your army is here."
An appalled silence descended on the group. In their minds, they could see the pure light hovering over the Black Saddle while the avatars poured out of the stronghold, laying waste to Girdlicard as they hunted for an evil that didn't exist.
"What are we waiting for?"
said Boindil after a time.
"We know where we're needed."
Black Saddle, Kingdom of Goregar, Girdlicard, early winter 6235th solar cycle. Theogil Hardhand gripped the chain with both hands and pulled as hard as he could. The block and pulley system made lifting the driverless wagon relatively easy. He hoisted it into the air and swung it away from the rail. The real question was how it had got there. He had arrived at the depot to find an empty wagon blocking the rail. he guessed it had rolled through the tunnel from a disused platform, in which case it was lucky it hadn't collided with a convoy of dwarves. At any rate, it had to be shifted. The last few thirdlings were preparing to leave the Black Saddle to join Lorimbas in the west.
"Let's get you moving," he muttered, pushing the wagon with one hand.
It was linked by a cable to a runner on the ceiling, so he barely had to steer. He stopped at the rear of the hall where the extra wagons were kept. Carefully, he lowered it to the ground, unhooked it from the cable, and placed his hands on the back to push it the final few places. Just then, he heard a noise. It seemed to be coming from the tunnel, and it sounded like a convoy of wagons rattling down the rails.
"New arrivals?" he thought in surprise,
ticking off the battalions in his mind. Every single thirdling unit was either waiting to depart from the Black Saddle or already en route to the west. Lorimbas's summons had caused consternation among the thirdlings, but orders were orders, and the warriors had left without delay. He abandoned the wagon and made his way carefully to the mouth of the tunnel. Holding his breath, he listened intently until he was sure of the source of the noise. It was as he thought. The rumbling and clattering was getting louder.
"Darned fools," he grumbled irritably. "What's the point of having a braking zone if they can't be trusted to leave a proper gap? They'll cause a pile-up."
He hurriedly tossed a few extra sacks of straw onto the buffers in the hope of saving the passengers from serious harm. Then he took up position in the signal box, intending to throw the lever as soon as the convoy arrived. By diverting the wagons onto different platforms, he could reduce the risk of a crash. He couldn't help wondering why the wagons were heading in his direction at all. Staring into the dark mouth of the tunnel, he waited for the lead wagon's lanterns to come into view. A few moments later, he glimpsed a light. A light so bright that he wondered briefly whether the sun had fallen through the rock. No dwarven lantern could cast a glow like that. As the wagons drew nearer, Theogil turned away, dazzled by the glare.
"What is it? A new invention, perhaps?"
Keeping his back to the tunnel, he decided to rely on his hearing instead. At last, he heard screeching metal as the brake blocks pressed against the narrow wheels, forcing them to slow. The wagon's arrival was heralded by a sudden rush of air. Theogil detected a strange smell that wasn't dwarven or human, and had nothing to do with elves or beasts. The wind tugged at his beard, set his chainmail a-quiver, and brought him the odor of oiled weaponry, polished metal, and clean hands. All in all, it smelled somehow pure. The first wagon shot out of the tunnel, illuminating every corner of the hall.
"Put the darn thing out!" he shouted.
The brightness was so unbearable that his eyes brimmed with tears and he had to close them. Thereafter, he worked in darkness, pumping the lever up and down and switching the points in time with the clattering of each wagon.
"Everyone out!"
he ordered, raising his voice above the din.
"Get the wagons off the rails or we'll have a collision!"
The light intensified, becoming so bright that he could see the red of his eyelids. The light shone straight through them, as if he were looking directly at the midday sun. He felt a sudden wave of heat, and someone grabbed him by the shoulder and pulled him away from the lever.
"Hey, you're burning me!"
he protested, feeling the searing pain in his shoulder. He opened his eyes and blinked. The creature in front of him was made of pure light. It was as tall as a human and wreathed in a white halo that was painful to behold. The air in the hall seemed to shimmer.
"Greetings, undergroundling," the creature greeted him in a kindly voice. "Don't be afraid. I won't hurt you if your soul is true."
Theogil reached for his club and took a step backward.
"Who are you?"
he asked gruffly.
"And who said you could use our wagons?"
With his free hand, he unhooked a horn from his belt and held it to his lips, but before he could sound the alarm, the creature stretched a hand, sending a bolt of light toward the horn, which ignited with a roar. Theogil dropped the bugle before his beard went up in flames. He knew without a shred of doubt what was happening. The avatars had arrived. In proper dwarven fashion, he gripped the club with both hands and brandished it menacingly.
"Be off with you! You've no right to bring death and destruction to these lands!"
"I beg your pardon," the creature said politely. "But our mission is to stamp out evil in all its forms. A dwarf girl told us that no Don has been destroyed. But we've heard of other creatures, creatures that worship Teon, or were fashioned by his hand."
The avatar took a step closer, and Theogil, who had spent countless orbits in the forge, was forced to draw back from the heat.
"Honorable undergroundling, descendant of the worthy Eskar, tell us where we can find the Alphar. Our soldiers will wipe out their army and burn their evil souls. You'll never have anything to fear from them again."
"Be off,"
commanded Theogil, raising his club.
"We'll deal with Inaste's pointy ears ourselves. No one asks for your help. You wipe out good as well as evil."
"Only the pure can look on us and live. Those who perish were found wanting."
Before Theogil could react, the avatar's hand was resting on his head.
"Are you pure, undergroundling? Or will you perish in our flames?"
Theogil felt crippled by the terrible heat. Red-hot metals seemed to press against his temples, cutting through his skull and desiccating his brain. His arms grew heavy and fell to his sides, and his fingers unfurled, letting go of the club.
"You should have told the truth," the creature admonished him. "Why didn't you tell us about the orcs? Taboribor is the name of their kingdom, is it? And what of the ogres? I see mountains swarming with ogres. The realm of Borwal, northeast of here."
He laughed, satisfied.
"Our army will be busy in Girdlegard. Soon the men, elves, and undergroundlings will be freed from Teon's beasts."
The creature released its searing grip on his head. Dazed, Theogil stumbled back and steadied himself against a metal rail.
"Don't interfere with the will of the deities,"
the avatar warned him, stepping back.
"Anyone who stands in our way is an ally of evil."
Theogil shielded his face with his hands to block out the light and peered through his fingers at the rest of the hall. Warriors were descending from the wagons and forming orderly lines. Their armor and banners were white, and they didn't seem to mind the glare, which was so intense that Theogil was afraid his eyes would shrivel in their sockets. He blinked just in case. The commotion in the depot came to the attention of the thirdlings in the other halls. Theogil spotted a group of sentries creeping down the wide stairway. As soon as they saw what was happening, they sounded the alarm. A bugle call echoed through the passageways and galleries of the Black Saddle, calling the children of Lorimbur, few of whom remained in the stronghold, to arms. The avatar paused and marched back to Theogil, who reached for his club.
"Poor stubborn undergroundlings," the creature said sadly. "We should be allies, but you've chosen to oppose us. We can't be held responsible for your deaths."
"Our deaths? I'll teach you to respect a dwarven warrior," growled Theogil.
He let out a ferocious war cry and bounded forward, swinging his club. Even before he reached his fiery antagonist, the heat became unbearable. His chainmail burned red against his skin, the air reeked of scorched leather, and his sinew and blood evaporated faster than a drop of water in a fire. Nothing remained of Theogil Hardhand but a mound of ashes and a few blackened bones. A moment later, They too were crushed and scattered by the pounding boots of the Avatar's soldiers as they charged the defending dwarfs. Kingdom of Goregar, Girdlegard, Winter 6235th Solar Cycle. Boindil trudged through the freshly fallen snow that lay like a coating of icing sugar over the fields, trees, and tents. He was the last to arrive at the meeting, and he made his way straight to the campfire and helped himself to a tankard of warm beer. Like the others, he was keen to have a nice, restful evening in preparation for their arrival at the Black Saddle at noon the next orbit. They were expecting to find the Avatars in the Dwarven stronghold.
"They've got a funny way of wiping out evil," said Boindil vehemently. "You can tell they're descended from Teon. Nothing good ever came of him."
He drained his tankard and went back for more. His pinprick eyes settled on Tungdil.
"Any news from our scouts?" "Only that the Avatar's cavalry has arrived in the stronghold," chimed in Lorimbas. "They rode part of the way underground, and the tunnels collapsed behind them." "How do you know?" asked Boindil. "Because of the cracks on the surface," explained the Thirdling King. "Most of our tunnels have been destroyed. Anything left standing after the comet and the earthquake has been brought down by the Avatars and their army."
Zamtis nodded. "I heard the same from my scouts. The underground network around the Red Range is dangerously unstable. Belendilin, Gandogar, and Glaimbar will have to send their armies overland."
"It won't be easy," said Tungdil,
turning back to the map. In his mind he charted the rest of the Avatar's route, which, assuming they stuck to their current course, would take them straight to Jon Balsur. "From their point of view, it makes perfect sense to attack the Alfar," he said. "They're the biggest threat to our safety, especially with the added power from the Dark Water. I'd say they were a worthy target for a band of demigods." "It's a pity the Avatars are so destructive," said Zamtis. "I mean, it's almost tempting to let them get on with it. They're capable of wiping out the Alfar, which isn't true of us. Ever since the Alfar butchered an entire camp of allied soldiers in Jon Balsur, the human soldiers have been deserting in droves. No one wants to face the Alfar."
"I'm not surprised," said Tungdil. "The Dark Water has made them deadlier than ever." He paused. "I've heard from our scouts that the snow around the Black Saddle has melted completely, while the rest of Goregar is covered in thigh-high drifts. Are you ready to take on the Avatars, Namora?"
The Maegar looked at the flickering flame of the lantern overhead. "I keep wondering whether my kind of magic can stop them," she said slowly. "My way is the way of equilibrium, the balancing of darkness and light. My power comes from both, but it might be better to attack them with pure light." She looked away from the flame. "We'll soon find out."
"I'll be right beside you, Maegar,"
said Rodario in a voice that he hoped was suitably comforting.
"I'll make them believe I'm the most powerful Magus in Girdlegard, so you can attack them without endangering your valuable person."
He took a swig of beer and grimaced. It was too bitter, too strong, too malty for his taste. "At least that's the aim," he added quietly. He lowered his voice again. "I hope you'll erect a statue in my honor when I'm dead." His comment was met with silence from the Maegar, who pretended not to hear. Tungdil noticed that Jeroen had positioned himself behind his new mistress, ready to spring into action at the first sign of danger. His damaged armor made him more intimidating than ever, the scratches and burn marks proving that neither swords nor fire could bring him down. Tungdil, thinking about it more carefully, realized that Jeroen's escape from the Avatars didn't make sense. The experience of those who had encountered the demigods confirmed the legend in every detail. The Avatars were in possession of magic powers capable of destroying all forms of evil. There were two categories of survivors: those who had the good fortune to escape their attention, and those who satisfied their cockeyed notion of purity.
But Jeroen is still alive, and they had every reason to kill him. He's a creature of evil, and he's powerful, which makes him 100 times more dangerous than orcs, Bognelim, or ogres.
A shiver of excitement ran down his back. He survived their attacks, and he survived for a reason. Without a word to the others, he went over to the giant warrior and ran a hand over his armor, following the lines and curves of the scorched intarsia, and studying the symbols etched by Belindus at Andokai's behest.
Is that the answer?
Rodario cleared his throat.
May I ask what you're doing, illustrious hero of the Black Saddle? I know it's hard for a dwarf to resist a good piece of metalwork, but don't you think we should deal with the avatars first?
Tungdil ignored him and turned to Namora.
Mega, ask Jeroen what happened when the avatars attacked.
Ask him yourself, she said. He understands you.
She listened to the giant's response, which she alone could understand.
I see. He says they attacked him with their magic.
Tungdil took a step back and thumped Jeroen's armor.
So why did he survive? The thirdlings were clad in armor and they perished in the Avatar's fires.
He turned to the others.
Jeroen is precisely the sort of creature they're out to destroy. They must have done everything in their power to kill him, and what did they achieve? Practically nothing, except cover him in soot. His only injuries were inflicted by their army.
You think he was saved by his armor? Said Boendal.
He could tell from Namora's expression that she was thinking the same.
Andokai must have found a counter charm to protect him.
Namora shook her head.
She would have told us. Why keep it to herself?
Maybe she didn't want to get our hopes up, suggested Rodario. Maybe she sent her knight in shining armor to see what happened when the avatars attacked. She was probably going to tell us when she knew for certain that it worked.
Not Andokai. She cared too much about Jeroen to put him at risk. The avatars weren't supposed to find him, but they did.
She signaled for Tungdil to step away from the giant. We'll try a little test. After warning Jeroen, she raised her arms and began an incantation.
Steady on, Namora, protested Boindil. You can't set fire to Jeroen in a tent.
The Maga continued undeterred. A tongue of fire pulled away from the lantern above her and flew into her outstretched hands, turning from orange to ruby red. The flame grew and expanded until it was the size of a human head. Then it cast itself, hissing and spluttering, against the giant's armored chest. There was a loud explosion, and Jeroen was wreathed in flames. At once, the runes on his armor pulsed with light, and the fire went out. Jeroen didn't so much as flinch.
Fine.
I'll take it up a notch, murmured Namora, raising her right arm and summoning tongues of fire from every lantern in the tent.
They gathered in her fingers, forming a red-hot fireball that she hurled at his chest. Again, the giant was surrounded by flames. This time the force of the impact brought him to his knees, but he straightened up as soon as the flames had died. He growled softly.
He says he felt the heat, but it couldn't hurt him, explained Namora, who was visibly surprised by what had occurred.
She clicked her fingers, and the flames returned to the lanterns, restoring light to the tent.
You'd better not say I was going easy on him, she told them. The fireball was hot enough to melt any normal metal.
She stepped up to the giant, inspected his breastplate, and laid a hand on the metal.
It's warm,
she said, shaking her head incredulously. The runes are still alight, but there's no sign of warping. She turned to the dwarves.
I think we can safely say that Belindus has forged a suit of armor that works against magic as well as swords.
Tungdil breathed out in relief.
Vrakus knew what he was doing when he gave us a talent for metalwork.
He's given us another chance to protect our lands.
Kneeling, he gave thanks to the dwarven deity. The other dwarves, with the exception of Lorimbas, followed his lead. The Thirdling King let his eyes glide contemptuously over their bowed heads. He felt like cleaving their necks with his axe, but he was their ally, for the moment, at least.
"Vrakus won't save you from Lorimbas's children," he vowed.
Tungdil was the first to rise.
"We need to summon Belindis," he announced,
buoyed by the thought that help was at hand.
"Send word that we need the instructions for Jerun's armor."
He wondered whether Vrakus was testing his character.
"I tried to get away from her, but it doesn't seem to work."
"We'll need 10,000 suits," said Boendal,
leaning on his crow's beak.
"I'm no coward, but I don't fancy our chances of fighting them without the magic armor. We'd be throwing away our lives."
Tungdil gave orders for 4 messengers to leave immediately for the Grey Range via 4 different routes. It was crucial that the message got through.
"We'll decide what to do when we see the situation at the Black Saddle tomorrow. I'd rather not fight without the armor, but we may not have a choice."
He pointed to the menacing black lines on the map that designated the kingdom of Jon Balsur.
"The Avatars are rumored to draw their power from the evil they destroy. Once the Avatars wipe out the Alfar, they'll be stronger than ever. Who knows if the armor will still work?" "Stop fretting," said Boindil cheerfully. "I can't wait for Belindis to forge me a fine new suit of armor. I'll teach the Avatars not to tangle with the dwarves. By the way, the first 10 are mine."
"There are only 11 of them,"
Boendal reminded him. The others laughed, grinning. Boindil clinked tankards with his brother.
"Tough luck," he said, chuckling. "You'll have to work it out among yourselves."
Their high spirits lasted until mid-afternoon, the next orbit, when the Black Saddle came into view. As they approached the mountain, they realized that the gloomy clouds in the grey winter sky weren't loaded with snow, as they had thought, but with smoke, and there was no doubt about the origin of the fire. The mountain without a peak had become a blazing pyre. The very rock of the Black Saddle was burning, the mountainside a sheet of red-hot fire, with tongues of flame rising from every crack and vent. Black smoke cut off the sunlight, obscuring the sky and turning the noon hours into dusk. Vast chunks of rock broke away from the Black Saddle and plunged to the ground. The snow had evaporated, and the soil around the mountain was powdery and dry. As they watched, the flames grew fiercer, leaping as if to ignite the sun.
"It doesn't seem possible," gasped Xamtis.
"How did they do it, Mega?" asked Boindil. "Did they turn the Black Saddle into coal?"
Namora's eyes narrowed.
"It's a warning," she said. "A warning to anyone thinking of following them. They're showing us their power."
"What a disaster," sighed Rodario.
"How am I supposed to recreate it on stage?"
He looked hopefully at Fergus, who shrugged. Tungdil shouldered his axe.
"Let's take a look at the damage."
The devastation was complete. At 500 paces from the Black Saddle, the snow turned to slush. 300 paces later, they were walking on firm, dry earth, raising clouds of dust with their boots. At a distance of 150 paces, they came to a halt. Any closer, and they were liable to be killed by flying rock. Scattered in the dust were fragments of axes and clubs, scorched bones and warped armor caked with charred flesh. The Black Saddle's defenders were no more. Lorimbas gazed at the devastation, eyes wet with tears.
"To you they were Thirdlings," he said quietly with a catch in his voice. "But to me they were friends. Friends whose deaths must be avenged."
The sight of the burning black saddle ignited the fires in every thirdling heart. For Lorimbas and his dwarfs, the war had become personal.
"We're done for," muttered Rodario, kicking at the powdery grey earth. "Surely we're all agreed that it's no good fighting men without Belindus's armour."
"We may have no choice," said Lorimbas grimly, looking at the grey trail left in the Avatar's wake. A vast path of dusty earth, 100 paces across and bordered on both sides by snow, was proof of the direction they had taken. The army was marching north. Lorimbas bent down and picked up an axe head. It was still attached to a charred fragment of haft.
"Goldhand is right. We need to stop them before they reach Jon Balsur and wipe out the Alpha. They're powerful enough as it is."
"Who would have thought it would come to this?" remarked Boindil. "All this time we've been trying to kick out Inaste's children, and at last there's someone who could do the job for us, but instead of letting them burn down Jon Balsur, we're going to jump to the Alfar's defense."
"It doesn't seem right," agreed Tungdil, "but we can't let the Avatars get to Jon Balsur. In any case, we're not defending the Alfar. We're postponing their death." He glanced at Lorimbas. "Can you spare 10,000 warriors? I want to outflank the Avatars and squeeze them between two fronts." Lorimbas nominated his elite battalions for the advance guard, which would consist of Tungdil, Namora, Rodario, and the twins. "We'll cut off the White Army before it reaches Jon Balsur," explained Tungdil. "Meanwhile, Lorimbas, Gemmel, and Zamtis will attack with the rest of our troops from the rear. Namora will take care of the Avatars." He thumped Boindil on the back.
"How's that for a challenge?" "No challenge is too big for a dwarf," said Boindil, although he didn't seem terribly confident.
It was late afternoon when Tungdil set off with 10,000 thirdlings on a northerly bearing. By the time they left the Black Saddle, the once legendary mountain resembled a broad-based hill, 50 paces in height and riven with cracks and fissures. By evening, when they stopped to rest for a while, it was gone. A few flames remained to mark the spot where the powerful Black Saddle had once stood. Teon's demigods had razed it to the ground. Tungdil was intent on catching and passing the Avatar's army. At night, its bright white glow was visible for hundreds of miles against the black firmament, but the dwarven warriors were still hopelessly behind. It seemed the White Army could march without rest. Their soldiers were on the move from dawn until dusk, racking up the miles, while Tungdil and the others were feeling the strain of 10 orbits of constant marching.
"Another 10 orbits, and they'll be there," said Boindil,
sitting down by the campfire to examine his blisters.
"We can hardly keep up with them. So how are Lorimbas, Gemmel, and Zamtis supposed to get there in time? We've got 10,000 elite thirdling warriors, and we're falling off the pace."
Tungdil pored over the map. The other dwarves at the campfire were thirdling generals. It was hard to tell from their tattooed faces what they were thinking.
"We said we'd strike here," he said,
lowering the stem of his pipe over an area of South Jon Balsur. He did some quick calculations.
"If we hurry, we can catch them right on the border. It's the earliest possible chance of attack. I'll send word to the others to tell them of the change of plan."
The thirdling generals listened in silence.
"It's risky, but it's the only way," agreed Boindil. "They'll speed up as soon as they see the border. They'll want to push on to the capital as fast as they can."
"I know, but we won't catch them beforehand," ruled Tungdil,
turning his attention to a written report from one of the scouts who was tracking the enemy army, unbeknown to the Avatars. So far, the invaders had laid waste to 4 towns en route to the Alfar's kingdom. The inhabitants had refused to join the army, in return for which the Avatars had plundered and burned their homes. According to the report, few had survived, for the most part children and young girls whom the Avatars had spared. Everyone else had been burned to a cinder like the Thirdlings at the Black Saddle.